From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2004 in Maryland when a couple was taking a walk. John and Diane Rehm walked every day when Diane returned home from a walk at WAMU, most days at least. And on this walk, Diane noticed something different about John. He was shuffling a bit. Recently, she had also noticed that he was losing weight and that his hands had a tremor. Doctors would soon diagnose her husband with Parkinson's disease. John Rehm lived with Parkinson's for 10 years. Over the course of that time, he developed complications from the disease, which affected his quality of life. Toward the end of his life, he spoke with Diane and with his doctors about medical aid in dying. The option, also known as physician-assisted dying, is currently legal in 9 states and Washington, D.C. Maryland, where Diane and John lived, was not one of those states. To end his suffering, John chose to stop eating and drinking. He died on June 23, 2014, with Diane at his side. They had been married 54 years. Since his death, Diane Rehm thinks about her husband and has become a leader in the Right to Die activist movement across the United States. She testified on this issue before the Maryland House of Delegates. She's written a book on the issue called When My Time Comes, and that is the title of a new film that premieres on WXXI this month. This hour, we are honored to be joined by radio host and legend, and that's a word that I use very, very sparingly, Diane Rehm. You know her, of course, from the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU. She retired in December 2016, but Diane, that's not a very good retirement. You're still working, podcasting.
I never retire.
It's not
and
really a
you
retirement.
You know, I said from the start, I am not retiring. I did the last show on WAMU on December 31st, 2016, and on January 7th, 2017, did my very first podcast. So there you are. That's the kind of retirement I wanted.
It is truly an honor to talk to you. And I want to let listeners know that the film, When My Time Comes, premieres Monday, April 12th. That's a week from tonight, 9 p.m. on WXXI TV. And you really ought to see it. In addition to broadcasts on local PBS stations across the country, the film will also air on the World Channel on April 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern and stream on all station-branded PBS platforms, including PBS.org, the PBS video app. It's available on iOS, Android, Roku, Apple TV. You can find it, and you really ought to be able to see it over the next 4 weeks starting on April 7th on some platforms. So whether it's WXXI TV a week from tonight from the many other platforms. Diane, your work for years involved direct open conversation, sometimes difficult and challenging conversation. And as your career progressed, you know, you got to see how the public discourse evolved on a wide range of issues, same-sex marriage, marijuana usage. And another, I think, is the story in this country of death with dignity. So when we think back to the early 90s and the way the American media was covering the story at the time of Dr. Jack Kevorkian, I have to admit, it's almost obscene to think about some of those headlines, the sensationalism, Dr. Death, all of that stuff. How do you think the Dr. Kevorkian story would be covered today?
Well, I think that, in fact, Dr. Kevorkian, though I did not care for his method, I think he set the discussion in motion. There were people who had reached the end of their lives because of illness, because of severe cancer, untreatable any further, people who were ready to die. I think that today Dr. Kevorkian would be appealing, as he did back then, to doctors and to the public for a more humane understanding of people's readiness to die. And he would have done it in a different way, I think. But knowing his personality, you know, he might have done it in exactly the same way. But now with medical aid in dying, as you so rightly said in your opening, available in 9 states plus the District of Columbia, and about to be available in New Mexico, where the House and the Senate in that state legislature have passed the law. It awaits the governor's signature, who has already said she will sign it. So I think maybe as early as this week, we will be able to say 10 states plus D.C.
Mm-hmm. In the 1990s, the term we often heard was physician-assisted suicide. But in the special When My Time Comes, doctors make the point that suicide is what happens when someone ends their life when they would otherwise continue to live, and physician-assisted dying is different. Why do you think that distinction matters in this public discourse, Diane?
Oh, it matters so much. People who are dying want to live, but they have no choice. Someone who commits suicide has a choice. Mm. So that in the film, a young woman, 37 years old, says, you know, if I had my druthers, I would live until I was 90. But breast cancer has spread throughout my body. It's in my bones. I don't want my young child to see me suffer. So I don't have a choice. And that's the big difference. Suicide is a choice. Medical aid in dying is for those who are within 6 months of death who have no choice.
Well, PBS viewers will see you tell the story of John Rehm, your husband of 54 years, and his death. And when he was nearing the end of his life in 2014, he did not have the options that you and he wanted. I sort of hesitate to ask this. I know it's very personal, but you describe it somewhat in the film. What was the end of his life like, Diane, compared to what you wanted for him?
Well, what we wanted for each other was simply a peaceful death in our own home with our children beside us. What he had to do, because Maryland had 4 times raised the issue in their House of Delegates and 4 times passed on it, what John Rehm had to do eventually, after his doctor told him he could not help him, he had to starve himself to death. He stopped eating, he stopped drinking water, he stopped taking medication. And you may know that you can go for 50, even 60 days without food, but without water, the organs begin to fail very quickly. So in those last 10 days when I was by John's side in the nursing home, you could just see the grimace on his face. You could just feel the pain, the agony he was going through, but he was such a strong man. And I tell you, it takes strength and courage to do what he did, but he was determined to do it. And at the last, I had spent the night at the nursing home, trying to sleep on 2 chairs with my little dog on my stomach, holding John's hand. And when his caregiver came in, I said, I'm going to run home, feed the dog, I'll be right back. And as soon as I walked in the house, he called and said, Diane, come quick. I think he's going. And I got there 15 minutes too late. So that was the death that neither he nor I wanted for him, and certainly not for myself. As a result of doing this film, I have changed doctors because my earlier doctor did not wish to participate in medical aid in dying, and I found a doctor who would be willing to do that.
Wow. John had told his doctor in no uncertain terms, I am ready to die. And
absolutely. Yeah. I am ready to die. And even his daughter, our daughter, who is herself a doctor, was on the phone with us from Boston. Our son was in the room as well. And she said to him, Dad, we can keep you comfortable. And he said, damn it, I don't want comfort. I am ready to die. And I would have been ready to die in his situation. He could no longer feed himself. He couldn't stand on his own. He couldn't toilet himself. He couldn't shower on his own. He had lost all dignity in his mind and said, I don't want to go further into indignity.
I think this is such an important point because often when we have a public conversation about medical assisted dying, there is this assumption, and I've probably made it myself in the past, that the real issue is managing pain. And that's important, but that is not the only aspect that matters and that would motivate certain decisions. Isn't that right?
Well, to be very clear, pain is number 6 on the list of reasons that people choose medical aid in dying. Number 6, loss of joy in life and a feeling of indignity are number 1. So that's the difference. That puts it all into perspective. For those who say, well, aren't there painkillers? Aren't there more and more medications that we can offer? I just received an email this morning from a woman whose story is so powerful. She lives in Florida. She is dying of cancer. She has no pain medication that she can tolerate. So her bones are deteriorating. Her chest is caving in. Her bones are breaking. And she said, I'm just going to have to die this way in pain. Talking to her doctor, he said, there's nothing else we can do for you. And so she wrote to me thanking me for the film and for the book. And let's be clear about one thing. This is so important. The film came first. I did not begin writing the book until we were about 1 year into the filming process. And then it occurred to me that I could take the dialogue from the film, from 25 of the more than 50 people we interviewed for the film, and expand the conversation that I had with each of those people. But it was not the other way around. So many people think the book came first negatory. The film came first, and the book would not exist without the film.
Well, in this film, you ask such an important question. You ask, what about a doctor's Hippocratic oath to do no harm? When it comes to physician-assisted dying, how does that interplay with this idea that a physician's oath is to do no harm? What have you found to be the answer to that important question?
Well, the answer varies depending on which doctor you're talking to. For those who are in favor of medical aid in dying, it is that the patient should be the one who determines whether harm is being done. By offering, for example, one more treatment, one more X-ray, one more radiation treatment, that simply may prolong by weeks or days a person's life. On the other hand, you have doctors who say, I am going to keep a patient alive as long as possible. That is their understanding of do no harm. But who should be the decider of harm? Who should determine how much pain I am willing to experience? Should it be the doctor or should it be the patient? Who should it be who defines harm?
Well, certainly I think many people might decide that it should be their own choice. It should be their own definition. And everyone will have different parameters, yeah.
And absolutely, you know, if a person says, my faith is going to determine when God decides to take me, and I support that view completely if that is that person's decision. Mm-hmm. If another person says, I want everything that you as a doctor and medical science can provide to keep me alive, I support that position. And I want you not to accept, but simply to understand that my position for myself should be to have the right to make my own decision for me. So let's look at this across the board as a situation where choice should be what's at play.
We're talking to Diane Rehm, who has been on our airwaves in various forms and, of course, with her eponymous shows for 37 years, and now with her podcast, with a new film coming to PBS and WXXI-TV 1 week from tonight. The film is called When My Time Comes, which happens to be the name of the book that came out of the film. And you can see that film 1 week from tonight, 9 p.m., WXXI-TV. It is about exactly what we are discussing here. Medically assisted dying, how many states allow it, what are the stories, and what is the impact when states finally offer this option. And I want to play a clip from the film. So in the film we meet Stella Dawson talking about Mary Klein, her wife and her longtime partner who suffered from ovarian cancer, and Mary and Stella's work and desire to see medical aid in dying as an option. So you're going to hear Stella Dawson discussing Mary Klein's suffering from cancer, and we also are going to hear from Mary's doctor in this clip.
She was enrolled in hospice and was very pleased with the hospice care she got.
Good.
And she was waiting as long as she could with the medications that we had that she could manage. And they weren't working anymore. They weren't working.
At the very end, I said, you know, I could give you enough medicine
so that you just would sleep for the rest of the time you have. And she said, I don't want that.
She did not want to be in a coma or a semi-coma at the end of her life. She wanted to be present. She wanted to be with me and the dogs. She wanted to be able to say goodbye.
Of course.
And it was that night that she said to me, Stella, it's time. You don't know it's going to be the end, do you?
No.
You don't?
No, you don't.
You know, even though she says something like that, I still thought she had several weeks.
I visited her 4 days before she died, and then again on the day that she died.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And Mary was dying that last time I saw her. She died from ovarian cancer. She did not die from the potion that she drank. That just affected the time she died. But she was already dying.
She just lay back and went into a very deep sleep.
And you were right there with her.
It was about 2.5 hours before she passed away. And she died in my arms. It's what she wanted. It's what she fought so very, very hard for. It's a peaceful death. And it's a loving death.
Oh, what a story. Diane, when you hear Stella telling that story, and then you think about 40 states that are not offering the same options, do you find it to be inevitable that it will be every state eventually, that there will be a decision that the public mentality, that doctors themselves will hear these kinds of stories from Stella and so many others in your film and in other settings, and will move in that direction?
That is so much my hope. I'm so glad you played that clip from the film, because Stella Dawson was such an articulate person talking about Mary Klein. Mary Klein played a significant role in the District of Columbia passing the law. And the fact is that younger doctors, when they are given these ideas, when they are given these stories, and I pray when they see this film, younger doctors are much more inclined to be open to the idea of medical aid in dying. Older doctors set in their ways and absolutely believing that they must continue to offer the next and the next and the next treatment, they are less inclined, which is why the American Medical Association again refused to change its stance on medical aid in dying, whereas the American Nurses Association has taken a neutral stance on this issue. So my prayer is that when people see this film, when they read this book and hear the stories of individuals who are going through this terrible stage, the end of their lives, that they will understand the importance of passing laws. 1 in 5 Americans currently has the right to make the choice. 1 in 5. Let's hope that more states think seriously about this.
We're talking to Diane Rehm, and the film that she's talking about is one that you can see premiering on WXXI-TV a week from tonight, Monday, April 12th at 9 p.m. It's called When My Time Comes. If you're wondering, by the way, about this kind of legislation in New York State, there was a bill introduced on February 1st of this year by a member of the Assembly, Amy Paulin. It's called the Medical Aid in Dying Act. It's got multiple co-sponsors, and it continues the history of the New York State Assembly to pass a medical aid in dying law, but it has yet to pass the full legislature. Right now, that bill has been referred to the Assembly Health Committee, and given history in the past, it's hard to assume anything this year, but there is some growing support in the legislative community. After we take our only break of the hour, we're going to welcome some feedback from listeners. Keith, hang there. We'll get to you. And listeners, if you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI, if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And listeners who know Diane Rehm will not be surprised to hear that her film and her work takes a very good faith exploration of the opposition to physician-assisted dying. It is absolutely, I think, compelling because Diane knows that you don't avoid the hard questions, you answer them, and you address them. And we're going to talk about that on the other side of this, our only break. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with urbanists in Rochester about their 2021 wish list. What are the rules, regulations, and changes they'd like to see in 2021 to give us a chance to have more connected communities, whether it's Rochester's inner loop, all of it, what to do with the space, parking, car-dominated cities and suburbs, and more. What the urbanists want next. Next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined by the great Diane Rehm this hour. Writing from Vancouver, Canada, Dave, listening online, says, I'm stuck starting to teach now, and I won't be able to listen further. Two of my friends, though, have chosen what they called dignity in dying over the last 2 years rather than endure horrible deaths. I hope this program gets people really thinking. All the very best from Dave in Vancouver. Thank you, Dave. And I have no doubt that it is happening. Diane's book and film are doing that. Let me get Keith in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, thank you for the show. And Diane, it's an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
Everybody's aware of what a DNR is, but to help alleviate problems that happens as we get older, and I fall into that category. Everybody should have a DNR, excuse me, and they also should have a healthcare proxy in place so there's nothing questioned. And the most important thing they should have in place is called a MOLST agreement. It's M-O-L-S-T. It stands for Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. So you can state in there, and it will be duly noted by your doctor, that let's say if you have severe COPD, you're having trouble breathing, you're at home, and the ambulance comes, you'll state in your MOLST agreement that you realize you're going to die, you don't want to be intubated. You want nature to take its course. Or if you're unconscious, excuse me, you don't want a feeding tube. You can set all that up prior, and then you don't have to worry about having to, what do I do with a loved one? They're unconscious, but they're dying tragically rather than going quickly or something. But back in the Obama years when Sarah Palin ran around the country talking about the death squads, how we're going to whack grandma, that's what basically Obama was encouraging elder people to have in place.
Okay.
A DNR, a health care proxy, and a MOLST agreement.
Well,
and that would cover a lot.
Keith, thank you for the phone call. Diane, you speak in this film about the importance of conversations, and you even demonstrate doing so yourself with your own family. What do you make of Keith's phone call?
Evan, he's quite right that you need to have all those things in place. Unfortunately, if something happens and 911 is summoned, the technicians who arrive at your door must, no matter what kinds of signs you may have posted on your refrigerator, on your dining room table, wherever, saying DNR or most, they are, by law, they must attempt to resuscitate you. Let me tell you the story of an 82-year-old woman who had everything, all the documents ready to go. She was taken to the hospital when she fell and had a heart attack. She was intubated, woke up in the ICU, and was absolutely furious that she was still alive. These wow. documents serve some purpose, but they don't go far enough, Evan, because you're absolutely right. What has to happen is that you have to have those conversations with your own family, with your next-door neighbor, with your doctor, with everyone you know, so that all are aware of your desires. And there is one final thing here that our caller neglected to mention. If you are taken to a Roman Catholic hospital, your chances of dying as you wish will not happen. The Roman Catholic Church owns and operates more than 18% of the hospitals in this country, and they do not recognize the right to die. So that you've got to be careful about whom you choose as a doctor and which hospital you decide to go to, if you go to any hospital. If it's a Roman Catholic hospital, your chances of dying as you wish are unlikely to be acknowledged. And you're right. I did, in the film, have a wonderful conversation with my darling grandson. And he filmed it on his iPhone while our filmmaker was filming him having the conversation with me, so that everyone in my family, all my friends, know exactly what I want at the end of life.
Well, you know, I hope my mother will be watching a week from tonight on PBS. My mother is 75. My stepfather is 88. He is a two-time cancer survivor. And my mother just cannot talk about it. She has told me time and time again, she has said, I am not ready for this to happen, and I'm not ready for this discussion. And
that's tough. And what I would say to you is that it's not one discussion. Mm-hmm. It's multiple discussions. And, you know, around the country, there are these death cafes where friends, neighbors, people who go to a church sit around tables, and there is one portrayed in the film in Massachusetts, where they have coffee, they have cake, and they talk about death. and they talk about it openly. You know, Evan, for your mother, it is the last taboo. And it is for millions of people in this country who do not want to talk about death, who don't want to think about death. I spoke at that same church. My first question to the congregation at about 350 people was, please raise your hands if you intend not to die. And of course, there was this titter in the audience. And that's the way it is. People are uncomfortable with it. If we can accomplish anything through this film and this book, it is to begin to open the dialogue between not only you and your mother, but people all over the country. It is many conversations, not just one.
Not just one.
She may say no now. Try her again a month from now.
I will do that.
See what happens. And see if she listens to this program. Surely she listens to your program each day.
Most days.
Most days.
Right, Mom?
No. Right.
Right. She'll listen to Diane Rehm over me, I promise you that. I have a lot of feedback I want to work through, and we'll get as much as we can in this hour with Diane Rehm. Roy in Rochester next. Go ahead, Roy.
Hello, Diane. This
Hi.
Is Roy from Rochester.
Hi.
I miss your show so much.
Thank
but
you.
But I'm glad to see that you've continued on.
Me too.
My partner was a first cousin of Janet Reno. And so Janet had, of course, an amazing family. And, yeah, they helped her through all of that all the way up to the end. And I guess it was a window for me because I was younger and couldn't quite imagine where the path goes. So I'm glad that you're giving us a window on what's coming out there in the unknown country.
Well, thank you for saying that. I must tell you, I had the honor to interview Janet Reno, and even way back then, I saw her hands shaking. I saw indications that there was something going on, and knowing that my husband later came down with Parkinson's disease, which, Evan, by the way, is what is on his death certificate, mm-hmm. Not that he starved himself to death, but rather that he died from complications of Parkinson's disease. So I thank your caller for his comments.
Let me read an email from Andrew who says, I have made a 180-degree turn in my opinion on this issue. In the past, I simply believed that no one should take their own life as all life is sacred. Now I believe that we should allow ourselves to live our best, and if we can no longer do that, that we should be able to choose to end our lives with dignity, therefore maintaining that sanctity of life. Anything otherwise is just a circus for others who should not have a say in how to run our lives. That is from Andrew. Diane, are you... do you observe public opinion on this? So what have you seen shifting over the years?
I have seen the shift. It's interesting. And in this era of COVID, I think the issue has become even more important, with people thinking about Well, what happens if mom is suddenly taken to the hospital and we haven't talked about what she wants? Does she want to be intubated? Does she want to be hooked up to all machines to keep her breathing? Does she want to go peacefully at home? Does she want to be in a nursing home? Does she want to be in a hospital? People need to talk about what they want. And you're helping to get this dialogue going, Evan, and I'm very grateful to you for doing that.
Well, it came as no surprise to me, Diane, that in your film, you were careful to engage what I think are reasonable and numerous points of opposition that some people have brought up to physician-assisted dying and death with dignity laws. And that's one of the other reasons I really encourage listeners to watch this film. Yes, it's advocacy, but it is good faith advocacy that acknowledges that differences of opinion might be strong, they might be layered, they might come from different premises. And so one of the ideas that people are concerned about, I want to talk about two of them. One of them is that when someone is in pain, physical pain, that they may make a decision to stop that pain, but they may be in a position where their pain could be ameliorated in some other fashion. And if they choose death with dignity, that is a decision that is permanent, irreversible. And that premise is why some have opposed these laws. What do you say to that, Diane?
Remember, the rules are, and these are all copied from the Oregon's Death with Dignity law. You must have been determined by two physicians to be within 6 months of death. That's the beginning. Then there is a two-week waiting period between the first and the second doctor. And then in some cases, in some states, there must be a psychiatric examination to determine whether there is any pressure coming from outside, mm-hmm. so that you must be alone in that room with the psychiatrist, not only to determine that there is no pressure, but that you are psychiatrically fit, mentally fit, to make this decision, so that pain cannot be the only reason to ask for medical aid in dying. You must be determined to be within 6 months of death. Mm-hmm. That makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. Your film also raises concerns that some people of color, particularly Black Americans, might have. They see inequities in a medical system that goes back decades. And some of the people that the film featured raised the concern that essentially sounds like this. If doctors have the option to allow a patient to die, what happens if they decide that, well, the cheapest way to treat this patient is to allow them to die? And that if history is a guide, it will be people of color, people who are living in poverty, people who do not have economic means, and this becomes another way of perpetuating inequality. What do you say to that?
There is inequality, no question of it. And there is mistrust on the part of African Americans, people of color, of the medical profession. Think back to the Tuskegee experiments with syphilis, when some were treated and some were not, all African Americans, who really feel that the level of care in this country is not fair. And they are absolutely right. And to hear from an AME pastor say to me, I would not recommend this to my parishioners unless I knew that those issues had been resolved. It's a matter of trust, Evan, and I don't blame them for not being trustful of the medical profession, which has treated them horribly. Think about, even now, the distribution of the COVID vaccine and how that has not gone to communities of color. But in the state of Florida, for example, has gone to the wealthiest communities. Mm-hmm. So those issues are definitely out there. It's going to take a long time to resolve them. The other issue that came forward here in D.C. was those who are afflicted with some disability. I was told by D.C. City Councilwoman Mary Jay that half of those who are disabled felt as though their lives might be taken from them, whereas the other half said, why can't I have death with dignity if I have a crippling disease that doesn't allow me to live with joy in my life? Why should I have to continue to live and breathe when all I want to do is die? Mm-hmm. But if that person is not within 6 months of death, medical aid in dying is not available.
All right, time is short. Jane in Rochester. Got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Ms. Rehm, I would like some reaction from you, please, of the things that Peter Singer out of Princeton has said. He relates to age as a criteria for getting a ventilator, if you recall, and that attitude of someone judging by how old you are. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that question, Evan.
I think she's concerned that Peter Singer, Princeton, and I don't know Peter Singer's direct remarks, but the idea generally that, you know, in sort of medical crunches, that we would divide ventilators or medically necessary equipment based on age, and it becomes a question of whose life is still relevant, whose life is worth saving. Probably a different issue.
Again, it is a different issue, but I have to tell you that as soon as the COVID virus struck, I called my own doctor and I said, if I come down with COVID, I do not wish to be hospitalized. I will not be intubated. I am 84 years old. I do not wish to undergo those treatments. I will simply go through it and see what happens. Okay. I do not, again, think we are talking about age here. We are talking about those who are within 6 months.
Yeah.
Of dying.
Yeah, for all ages and all reasons. In our last minute, let me just ask you briefly, separate from this very important conversation, your work over the years set a benchmark in how journalists and how talk show hosts can handle interviews with people in power. And as media expands, Diane, often what we have are political leaders who feel like they don't have to talk to journalists anymore. They can tell their own stories. They have their own platforms. Does that concern you? Do you see any change, any sort of trend there?
I think you and people like you who are still on the air every day have to keep asking the questions. If those politicians continue to use their own platforms to spread their own truths or falsehoods. I think the public needs more and more education from good sources, and that's where the responsibility falls back to the individual. You and I, Evan, cannot make them listen. We just have to stay with the truth, stay with the honest questions, be fair and honest ourselves.
You are a role model for me and so many of my colleagues, and it is my honor to talk to you, Diane.
Oh, thank you so much, Evan. It was my great pleasure.
Diane Rehm created the film that you can see next Monday on PBS and WXXI-TV. It's called When My Time Comes. Monday, April 12th, a week from tonight, 9 p.m. Please watch. Please share it. And you can find it on various streaming platforms. Starting later this week, you can share it and make sure everyone is thinking about these issues. That is the great Diane Rehm, and more connections coming up in a moment.